Good morning, everyone, and very pleased to be here to talk to you. I've got a number of things I would like to talk to you about, I think about 5 or 6 points. I thought I'd tell you a bit about myself and how I got involved in the mindfulness business, and something about breathworks, how breathworks fits in with Buddhism, and sort of, you know, if there's any kind of connection with the Buddhist teaching and what we do. A little bit perhaps about my views about Buddhism and secular mindfulness, and perhaps talk a little bit about mindfulness in particular for men. I'd like to say a few things about that, and then just why mindfulness is or awareness is revolutionary, what I think. So it's what I'm hoping to do this morning. So I'd like to go back 14 years to a solitary retreat that I led in, not led. One of the few retreats I didn't lead, that I had, just to help me get into the talk. I just set the scene. It was probably in the most unsuitable place for a solitary retreat. If I'd been a little bit more on the ball, I would have recognised immediately the place by its name wasn't going to be suitable. It was called the Lodge. I think it was a gatehouse or something like that. Anyway, it was on a main A road. And not only did the road come up, go by, it actually seemed to go round the gatehouse thing. So it was very noisy. And when I got there, I was very disappointed. And so I tried to meditate with earplugs. Kind of was too lazy really to cancel it and go somewhere else, and it just seemed too complicated. So I decided what I would do is go for long walks, and it was late November, early December, and it was a very beautiful area in North Wales, and I just went on these long walks for 4 or 5 hours a day. And I decided what I would do while I'm on those walks was to be mindful. I wasn't in the mindfulness business then. I just was an ordinary member that knew about mindfulness. And I'd always been fascinated about my mind and what my mind does and thoughts. And I think I'm probably, if you look at various categories of learning styles, I'm probably a logical, analytical thinker. So, you know, I probably might not think that well, but that's kind of what I like. I like to get information, think about it, it needs to make sense to me, and so on. So I was going for these long walks and just watching what happened in my mind. And I did this for several days. I did pujas in the evening and sat with earplugs in before there were too many lorries going past the door in the morning. And after, I can't remember where it was, maybe it was probably about a two-week retreat, two-week period. But after about 10 days or something, I had a very strange experience one evening where I came to the conclusion that everything that was going on in my mind was just rubbish. It was like just thoughts. And then I realised that even the thought that it was a thought, that it was rubbish, was just another thought. And it was a bit like, it was all seemed so ludicrous what was going on, you know, I thought, I'm leading the spiritual life in order to get enlightened. And I thought, well, that's just thoughts. And I persisted in this way for a while. And then I had this kind of moment where I just lost confidence in everything. I just thought, you can't possibly live a spiritual life because it's just a thought. And the idea of there being a you or another, it's difficult to kind of talk about it really, but it just left me feeling like I might as well just watch TV. I couldn't really see any point in continuing living really, because that was like life was just a thought, and it just seemed just as ludicrous as everything else. And but it was a kind of real important turning point for me. I did actually give up and watch TV and watch a movie. And there was one movie, in fact, I watched two movies. I won't tell you the first one, but the second one was an interesting movie it called The Long Goodbye with Emma Thompson in it. And one of the things that really moved me in that, it was a very sad movie, very poignant, but this person dies of cancer, in the character in this movie, played by Emma Thompson. She dies of cancer, and she's got no friends around her. And so it made me, I don't know why, it set off another thought in my mind, and I kept thinking, well, that's a thought, here comes another one. But I thought, this isn't a very good state to be in, you know, to be sitting here watching movies and having lost confidence. So what am I going to do? And I thought, well, maybe I need to feel something, you know, rather than go with logic and what was a good idea. What did I feel like doing? What was important to me? And this film just made me realise that friendship and caring about other people was important. So that was that moment kind of changed the direction of my life, really. And ironically, I came back to Margie Maloka, where I was living, and Banti was having trouble sleeping at that time, and I was one of the people that was staying with him and caring for him. I found it incredibly difficult caring for another person where, you know, I was called upon to give up my sleep and, you know, my activities and just be there for him doing what he wanted and so on. And but it occurred to me this was such a good way to try to live the spiritual life, because if the spiritual life is about overcoming this kind of tightness of self, of having a, you know, being so attached to our views and all the things we're attached to, just caring about another person, putting them before you, seems such a powerful way of practicing. And who could be more be more of a teacher than your teacher? And Banti can be very demanding in as a teacher. You know, demands a lot of us, and we have to have long discussions about, you know, whether we agree with it and things like that. But fortunately for me, I didn't have to care for Banti for too many weeks, because he had someone else who came in, stepped in. So I at that time, I'd formed a relationship with Vidyamala. And Vidyamala was someone at that time who was having... Well, she's lived with chronic pain most of her life since she was 16. She's now 54, I think. And I just found her such a remarkable woman. I don't think I've got in a relationship with her because I fell in love, or I mean, it was a sexual relationship particularly. It was just that I found she was an amazing person, and just being around her was, you know, sort of became more and more amazing when I got to know her. And I was fascinated by how someone could be in so much pain and be so positive and cheerful and so active and caring about others. So I was, I started spending more and more time with her. And I realised what she needed was a carer. And so, to cut a long story short, I eventually became a kind of professional carer, and I even got paid to care for her. So I was going up to Manchester 3 days a week and being her carer, which was a bit of a change from being a public preceptor and being very much in the central, you know, sort of meetings of the movement. So here I was just cooking someone's breakfast, doing the shopping, cleaning the house, driving her places, washing her clothes and things. And, you know, some of the people in the women's community used to tease me a little bit about that, like, you know, having fallen from on high. But it was all in good humour. And I saw it as a challenge as well. And it is challenging, isn't it? You know, if you've got a certain status, and then you... I mean, Vidyamala said to me, you know, status must be important to you. You're a public preceptor. It must be make a difference, you know. And I thought, I didn't relate to... I didn't ask to be a public preceptor. I was just told to be one. So I didn't... But I thought, maybe she's right. Maybe it is status. So this is a good test, you know. So I started spending quite a lot of time with Vidyamala. And at that time, she had just been on a workshop, or maybe it's the second workshop we've been on, with someone called John Kabat-Zinn, who Vishvapani mentioned yesterday as being kind of like the grandfather of the secular mindfulness movement. And she said, I remember driving her up to Cumbria, where we were going to have a sort of weekend together, that she was kind of going on about how great he was, the way he taught meditation, and you know, how it was kind of transformative for her. And I was getting slightly irritated by this, as one often does being a Tri Ratna order member, thinking you can't really learn from other people. And we know best and all that. But she got a bit irritated with me not being very enthusiastic. But gradually, becoming a bit more inquiring and finding out what was it that he had to offer that we were missing perhaps in our own system of practice, And it took quite a while, but I kind of discovered that gradually there was this mindfulness movement starting to gather momentum. I think Jon Kabat-Zinn spent about the first 15 years of his career setting all this up, sort of looking out at the world, and then after an important TV program, the world started looking in on what he was doing, and that was when the whole thing started to slowly gathered momentum as a kind of secular mindfulness movement, is what people call it these days, I guess. Vidyamala then thought that she would really like to train with Jon Kabat-Zinn and, you know, become a MBSR trainer. But she didn't have the resources to do it. She didn't have the sort of physical resources to go to America. That's the only place you could go to and train as a teacher. And it was a three-month training, I think, that she was looking at. She didn't have the money. She didn't have the resources. So she thought, well, I've been meditating for quite a long time. I've lived with chronic pain, and, you know, I've got I've got the kind of message that Jon Kabat-Zinn was giving and how it all fits together, that she thought she'd devise her own program. I mean, she could have just gone off and used the MBSR model, but she didn't feel that was really authentic, and she didn't want to do that. And she's got a very, very good relationship with Jon Kabat-Zinn. He really admires her. And, you know, if he sees her, he usually goes up and talks to her straight away. So she told him what she was doing, and he just encouraged her. And she devised a mindfulness program that is the one. It was the beginning of Breathworks. Initially, it was called Peace of Mind. And a few years later, Ratnaguna and I kind of amalgamated with her. And we came up with the idea of setting up a company called Breathworks. And so that's how Breathworks was born. Because I had this moment, this kind of, I don't know if it was a kind of an insight, but it certainly changed my life on that retreat. The idea of caring for people, what she was doing on with this course was to teach mindfulness, teach meditation, teach what she had learnt to people with pain and illness. And I started becoming, well, I was very, very encouraging of her to do it, as was Moksha Priya, who was chair at the Manchester Buddhist Centre. And she, you know, she was a bit kind of uncomfortable about doing it first, but with a lot of encouragement, she went ahead and did it. And she advertised a course for people in Manchester with pain. And she got about 50 people signing up immediately. It was virtually free. I think they had to just pay a small sum, but there was just, you know, such a big rush of people wanting to do the course. And she had a course with perhaps 15, 20 people on it. And she had a small grant from the government to pay for a carer and an assistant and to buy some equipment and things for running this course. Once that course had gone, she had no money left, so she wasn't able to continue. But I started working, she did manage to continue, and she had to start charging some money for the courses. So I started working with her, and I met these people. I've never met people with chronic pain before. Vidyamala was the first person I'd met who I knew had chronic pain. And it was a bit of a revelation to me that people walking around, or not even walking around sometimes, just lying in bed all the time, who are living with terrible pain all the time. And the thing about pain is it's a hidden disease. So I'm sure there's quite a lot of you in this room who have got chronic pain. Chronic pain is usually defined as a continual pain that lasts for 3 months or more. Some people say 6 months, but it's something like 1 in 7 people in the UK have chronic pain, and 1 in 5 people in Europe have chronic pain, and even more, I guess, in third world countries. One doesn't even know, and that's done on research. Those figures are quite old now, but it's probably even higher with an ageing population. They're figures that were produced about 10 years ago. What I found going to the courses with Vidyamala was that I was with meeting remarkable people. There were people who had the kind of courage to come to a Buddhist centre to join in a pain management course. She called it Living Well with Pain and Illness, which kind of describes what we were trying to do. And it's just meeting these people just made me feel so moved. You know, that they're, when they describe what we do at the first class, we get people to talk about their diagnosis and what they experience. And that's all they're allowed to talk about it during the course. You know, then we just talk about mindfulness. Otherwise, it kind of drops into being a support group. But when people were talking about their condition, I remember sitting there feeling, well, first of all, I would say, before I went there, I was kind of apprehensive. I thought, how am I going to cope being in a room with 15 people who are going to tell me they are suffering so much and I don't experience any pain? And Vidyamala said to me, you have to go there as one of the participants. Right. So I said, well, what am I going to say? She said, well, I don't know, you don't sleep well, you know. And so I said, okay, I didn't sleep. I was having sleep problems at the time. So I went there and I sat there and I felt honoured. I literally felt honoured. And then gradually there was so much humour in the room. People talked and people were in tears when they were telling about their condition and what it done to their life. It completely devastated most people's lives, their condition. And when... it's quite moving, this, because this happens most of the time when I do a course, is that people talk about their condition and you feel so privileged to be there. I suppose so lucky not to be in pain yourself. And there you are sort of with these people. It's challenging because you think, what can I do to help them? I don't know what's going on. But Vidyamala assured me that all I needed to do was teach them mindfulness. I didn't need to know what it was like to be in pain. She said, you can't imagine what it's like to be in continual pain, because you can only imagine not having pain and then having pain. But if you've got it all the time, you can't even imagine what it's like not having pain. So that's the kind of population we were dealing with. I just wanted to help her. I just felt this is something I wanted to do. I wanted to make it part of my spiritual practice. And I saw no conflict in doing that. I thought, here are people that are really suffering. And because it was physical, and although it is a hidden disease, you can see that people are suffering, the way they move, you know, they need so much help. And Vidyamala insisted that what those people needed when they came to our courses was looking after. So we would take a note of what they wanted for tea, we would get them to lie down, I'd go and offer them blankets, make them comfortable. And even now, if I do that to people, I mainly do it on teacher training, but there's still the same sort of people sometimes come. They just can't believe it. They say, no, it's all right, I'll cover it. And I say, no, I'll cover you over. And then they're just so pleased that someone is looking after them in that way. And even that in itself is almost enough for some people, the fact that someone's suddenly caring for them. And anyway, I could just talk. I've used up already a big chunk of my time telling you about this. But it was very important for me. And I think I want to tell you that because it could be important for you. It could be what makes mindfulness as a healthcare intervention an interesting thing for you to consider doing, because you will work with people that have got conditions who very often are remarkable people. And quite a few of those people that have come to those courses are now training for ordination. They've met order members, they've seen Vidyamala, they've seen me, they've seen Ratnaguna, and there's more and more order members that are Breathworks teachers. And they meet us and they want to go further with their mindfulness practice. And so we've been quite successful in attracting people towards Tree Ratna and into the order. So that's how breathwork started. That's how I became interested. And I was, working with Vidyamala. One Christmas with her brother, who was a corporate lawyer, he said, well, where do you want to go with all this? You know, what do you want to do? And she said, well, I'd like to help as many people in the world as possible with suffering. He said, well, how are you going to do that in Manchester, running a course once a week for 15 people? And she said, well, I don't really know. And he said, well, it's obvious really, isn't it? You need to teach people who are going to teach people. So that's what we started to do. And we thought if we could make any money out of it, it would be by training up people to become teachers and then go on and do it. So Ophidian, I'll tell you a little bit about Breathworks now. Breathworks is based around loosely around MBSR. It's an 8-week course usually, although we do variations of that. We don't feel limited to 8 weeks. We can be very, it's because it's our own thing. We can do it in any whatever way we want to. But Vidyamala added a number of things that she felt were missing for her in the MBSR course. One was something called what she calls pacing. This is a quite common thing in, used to be a common thing in pain management programs in the NHS. A lot of people suffer in life because we don't pace ourselves. And what here, if English isn't your mother tongue, pacing might be a new word to you, but it's what sports people do. I mean, you run a race, you pace yourself. You don't run a long race by sprinting out front and then running out of fuel. So you learn to pace yourself. And so people with chronic pain and illness, they get tired. And when they get tired, their pain flares up. When the pain flares up, they have a shorter fuse. They get more irritable and so on. If they learn to pace themselves more carefully and be aware, be mindful of what they're doing during the day, then they can have more resources and have less suffering. So she introduced a module that comes from the pain management programs. It's based around CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy. And she also decided that the metta bhavana was very, very central to her life and to her being able to deal with pain. So we devised a program that used the Tri Ratna standard teachings of the mindfulness of breathing in 4 stages, counting in the first 2, etc. And the metta bhavana was just a straight metta bhavana. The metta bhavana gradually got changed into something called kindly awareness, which was a bit more angled towards helping people to sit with a painful body to start with in the first stage, to be, you know, accepting of actually in pain when they meditate and feel, you know, wish themselves well and feel good towards themselves, which a lot of people don't, particularly when their life has been smashed up. In fact, most people don't feel good. You kind of discover nowadays that most people don't feel that good about themselves. And I'll say a bit more about this later. We had quite a discussion about this, introducing these two elements into our program. Some people said it wasn't mindfulness. You know, the purists said this isn't proper mindfulness. Vidyamala talked to John Kabat-Zinn about it, and he kind of took the approach, well, if it works, why wouldn't you use it? Which is, you know, Vidyamala being a pragmatist, that's what she decided to do. I was very, very keen that I wanted my Tri Ratna background and what we were doing at Breathworks to somehow overlap. And I've always found the metta bhavana really, really important to me. I've been doing it for 40 years or so more, and I still do it regularly. So it's a very important practice, and I can see how powerful it is. So anyway, we just persisted and went our own way, and gradually people started respecting what we were doing. Fortunately, Vidyamala collected a lot of research material. She knew that when you go to hospital, you have to fill out loads of forms before treatment and after treatment. So she started doing that right from the beginning of running courses. And after 5 years, we had a big pile of papers, which eventually were computerized, digitalized, and then number crunched, and graphs and things were produced. And we had an evaluation program that showed how Breathworks was effective. We were then invited to give a conference or workshop at the annual scientific conference of the British Pain Society, and where we presented our evidence and did a workshop to 100 people. And then from there on, Vidyamala was invited to give talks at conferences, and she's still doing that today all over the place. Gradually, she came around to writing a book. And then she's written another book with an author called Danny Penman called Mindfulness for Health. The first book was written with Vishwapani as editor, Living Well with Pain and Illness. And then she's written another book called Mindfulness for Health with Danny Penman, who wrote a book with Mark Williams, which is probably the number one best-selling mindfulness book in the world, I suspect, at the moment. And the Vidyamala's book is selling very well. She's... A few weeks ago, several weeks ago. She won an award. It's the from the British Medical Association for the best clinical book of the year, I think. Popular medicine. It was. It wasn't about tapeworms and things, but it was about. So it's a mindfulness, and it apparently when the librarian was, you know, announcing the awards at the do, Vidyamala Dittenkatt was on retreat. She wasn't there, but you know, Danny and a representative was there. It was the only book she said to the audience, "This is a must. You must read this." So it was a great accolade to what she had done. So breathworks, particular in this kind of niche market of working well, working with people with pain and illness, has gathered a lot of respect over the years, and I'm very proud to be a director of the company. Breathworks is as a right from the beginning, I had this idea that breathworks could be a right livelihood business. I thought, actually, you know, the people in our order are half trained already. More than half trained. They know about how to meditate, they know how to sit still and be with themselves, etc. And they just need it, you know, to know how to use that as a healthcare intervention. So that was one of my, you know, desires, that we made it somehow part of Tree Ratner. We're still working on that as a right team-based right livelihood. We're not quite sure what it means to be a team-based right livelihood. It's more, you know, Ratner Gosha gave us one idea, is that we give away 1% of our annual income. Our annual income's increased to a degree where we're not able to give away quite that much, although we'd give a couple of £1,000 away to Tree Ratner each year, but we would like to give more. But we've been growing. We've grown at the rate for the last 3 years of 30% a year. So 3 years ago, we had an annual income of about £100,000. And now it's estimated this year's income is going to be well over £300,000. And we're building infrastructures and we're expanding as a business. And we hope to be able to expand in more and more countries. We've got teachers, I think, in 22 different countries. And not many, you know, I don't want to kind of spin this as though we're bigger than we are, but people come from all sorts of places to train with us. And our teacher training program is respected and recognized in the UK as fulfilling the guidelines for... there are guidelines to what makes you a kind of good mindfulness teacher, and we fulfill those guidelines. And in fact, we were party to producing those guidelines with Bangor and Exeter, well, initially just Bangor. Do we make a profit, though? You know, you can make a lot of income, but you know, if you're in a business, you really need to be able to make money to pay yourself a decent wage and to make a profit. Well, the answer is so far, no. In fact, every year we make a loss, and just like Britain, as long as there's growth, you can deal with a loss. I'm kind of beginning to understand how capitalism works now. So you can just, you know, make a loss this year because you know there's going to be more money coming in next year. And you can keep going until it all flattens out, and then you really are in the, you know, where you end up. So is it interesting for you to become, say, mindfulness teachers? Well, at Breathworks, what we've discovered, if you wanted to do... We do two programs now. We kind of branched out into doing mindfulness for stress, people with stress, just kind of like normal stress, you know, people that have busy lives and frantic lives and just, you know, stress. And we modified our Living Well with Pain and Illness program, or Mindfulness for Health program, as it's called now, to deal with this. And we get a lot of people coming on our courses. So I'll let you do the sums. If you have 20 people wanting to come on your course and you charge them £200 and you have to pay a few pounds out in facility charge, you make a really good profit. And it's not that difficult to get people who are stressed to come on courses, it seems. I've never been that interested. I was interested in getting the stress course going. It was a pain and illness course. It's always been the one that I really have been keen to do. So you can, I mean, Breathworks in Manchester, we do run courses and we make a profit from those courses, but we have such a big organisation now with 10 people working for us. It costs a lot of money running that, and so that money disappears. But the pain, the people with pain and illness, usually they're out of work, they're on benefits, and they're struggling, and you can't really make money out of those people. You know, you can't charge people... Even £50 sometimes is too much for them to come on an 8-week course. So it's so what do you do? You know, what can you do for those people? Well, hopefully through the research we're trying to develop and more evaluations, there may be Breathworks courses on prescription for people with pain and illness. That would be one way of funding it. But not everyone's, even the NHS hasn't got much money. So whether that's going to happen or not, I don't know. So we've set up a charity called the Breathworks Foundation. And one of the aims and objects of the charity is to collect money in to give to Breathworks CIC to provide courses for people in the socioeconomic group who can't afford to go in our courses. And so we're kind of launching this you know, charity. It's been going for a year. So far we've been given a... it's not an endowment. We've been given a gift that amounts to £7,000 a year for the next 20 years. So, you know, someone wanted to give us a lump sum and we kind of worked out an interesting system, which I could talk about at another time, where that money will be paid to Breathworks regularly for the next 20 years. And that £7,000 will be used as a donation to the CIC, which is a company I run, the Community Interest Company, which will provide a number of places to people to do courses who are in pain and illness, either teacher training courses, because sometimes the best teachers are the ones that know, that have been through a course and know what it's like and what it can do for you. But for other, maybe from other people, like from, we had someone from Hungary who wanted to train with us, they didn't have the money, so we could provide them with a bursary sort of place. So not that we're going to ask Tree Ratner for this money, but it is there if anyone feels they know someone. We're going to we'll have a leaflet that people can give people explaining what we do and why we do it, and a website up and running soon. So we're trying to collect money, and I think once we can get that really going and we're getting hundreds of thousands of pounds coming in, then that will feed the CIC with a more regular income and everything will be a bit more stable, and I'll be able to sleep at night not worrying about finances, which I don't really worry about nowadays because other people do. So that's Breathworks. And what is Breathworks based on? Well, one of the things we discovered after we got going is actually it's based on the teachings of the Buddha. Surprise, surprise. The first teaching that I came across really was the teaching of the two darts, the two arrows, the Salata Sutta. And in that, the Buddha, very quickly, and the pith of the teaching really is that the well-trained disciple, maybe that means the arahant, when he's pierced by an arrow, he accepts that he's pierced by an arrow. The untrained disciple, when he's pierced by an arrow, i.e. us, when we're pierced by an arrow, we go, "Ah, oh, I'm in pain. Oh, it's terrible." And what we usually do is we resist the pain. We don't accept it. We don't want to have the pain. And we resent it. You know, someone's hurt me. Who did this to me? Why did they do this to me? You know, what's it going to do to my life? And so it causes you more suffering. It's as though you got pierced by another arrow. So first of all, you've got the primary arrow that's causing this pain, and now you're created all this other suffering. So that the two darts, and this is what we teach people, is that you've got pain and illness. It's a chronic condition. You've had the operations. You've got the medication. There's not really very much we can do for you in that respect. But, hey, what else is going on in your life? You know, are you anxious? Are you losing sleep at night? Is your body tense because of the pain? There's all a number of secondary conditions that come about because of that resentment, of that resistance to the pain. And so this is what we teach people, is how to accept, how to move, live their life with their condition. And we're teaching people simple things like we all know, although we forget. We're not our thoughts. You know, we take our thoughts as being us very often, so identified with them. But just discovering we're not our thoughts means that actually you can have thoughts like, what am I going to do if this condition gets worse in the future? You could sit there and worry about that, or you could sit there at this moment and think, well, actually, at this moment, I'm breathing, I feel quite comfortable, and I don't need to think about the future. I know it sounds easy, and it isn't easy, is it? It's more difficult than that. But once you get the idea, is you don't have to be a victim to your own thoughts. You can actually start working and unpicking and letting go of being the victim of your situation. And then if you're in a situation which you can't really do anything about, you can accept it. And you accept it and you can live with it. And then you can have a quality of life that can be completely transformative. And that's what people get from breathworks very often. Their lives are transformed. And they suddenly realise they can have a quality of life living with terrible pain. And it's wonderful. The other sutta is kind of Ratnaguna went into this, and I think with Vishvapani a bit, with thinking about the stress course and how, what is there some sort of basis on which that's built. And that seemed to be similar to that experience I had in 2002, where I realised my thoughts were ludicrous. It was just like this prapancha. In fact, the word prapancha I came across in a kind of dramatic language means something like ludicrous dialogue. And I realise that's what most of us have a lot of the time, just ludicrous dialogue with ourselves. And it causes so much suffering. And I it's called the Honeyball Sutra. I don't know what honeyball is. I tried to discover what a honeyball is. But the image that came to me, because it's described as the categories of prapancha described as thinking, desire, dear or not dear, envy, stinginess, rivalry and hostility. It seems like there's a thread of each of these sort of stages we go through. And I thought, actually, my thinking's like that sometimes, but it's a bit like a thread that's dipped in honey, and it's wound round itself, and it creates this ball of thoughts, and which is just a gooey mess in the end, a little sticky. And trying to unpick that seems to be very problematic. And so the Honeyball Sutta is also, underlays our teachings, which I find really important to know that what we're doing is what the Buddha was teaching, all those years ago. Buddhism and secular mindfulness. Well, we had a bit of a discussion about that yesterday. And, people often want to know, is mindfulness the Dharma? I think it's really not, I think it's a wrong sort of question. I think you can't really, you can ask that question. Of course you can ask that question. But what does it mean? And I've been in many discussions where people are trying to work out, is it the Dharma or not? And there's those that argue for it and those that don't argue for it. I just think, forget it. Why worry? Does it lead you to becoming more? Does it help you to become more as an individual, help you on the path to enlightenment? Well, probably yes. I think Bhante said somewhere once that if you just practice mindfulness and nothing else, eventually you would gain enlightenment. It might take you several lifetimes, but, you'd eventually get there. Because when you become aware of where what's going on, you gradually become aware that you can have choice and you can make changes, etc. But there are quicker ways to gaining enlightenment. So there's a kind of doing method. You actually do things that help you to become enlightened. I don't think it's a direct path to enlightenment. Otherwise, I'd probably be advocating closing down our Tri Ratna centres and turning them into breathwork centres. Someone said, I was talking to someone at breakfast this morning, they thought, that's a good idea. they like the idea of having Buddhism without Buddhism. But for me, personally, I love Tri Ratna. I've given my life to Tri Ratna. And I think there are lots of things we do in Tri Ratna which we don't do in Buddhism. First of all, we know what's in the centre of our mandala. Usually we put lots of other things in with the three jewels. But we know the three jewels are there. We have an awareness of some kind of higher state of being, surely. It's not just to be happy and have a more comfortable life. We're doing this for some sort of higher reason, which is very difficult to talk about, but we call it spiritual, I suppose, spiritual path, transcendental path. As far as I can see, no one in the mindfulness movement wants to talk very seriously about a code of ethics, apart from codes of ethics of how to be a good teacher and things like that. Because that's problematic, isn't it? Because to have a code of ethics, you have to have a system of ethics. And the system of ethics usually is built upon a religion. I don't know where materialism stands with codes of ethics as humanist. Maybe there's a humanist code somewhere. So you'd have to decide which kind of code of ethics you were going to stand on. But it's not something, in the 10 years that I've been going to conferences and workshops, I've never heard anyone talk about ethics. Fortunately, most mindfulness teachers are kind, and they probably think life is worth saving and life-enhancing sort of direction. And they kind of, in a way, they exude that. They communicate that's what they believe. So maybe they felt there's no need to talk about ethics. But if you wanted to be clear, if someone asked, well, what's the ethical stance on being, say, a vegetarian if you're doing mindfulness, that would be problematic, I think, for a lot of people, because that would, kind of bring you into conflict with the world. And most people in the world are not vegetarians, for instance. So I think a system of ethical precepts that I follow is really helpful. I like that. I like having 10 precepts. I know what I can work on in myself. I can actually use mindfulness to practice those precepts better, actually. So that's important. We have an emphasis on friendship in Tri Ratna, and it's something we've brought into Breathworks, that we try to build community of our teachers, so that we can get together and support one another, practice together, do a retreat together once a year if we want. We're doing a retreat here next year for people, not just in Breathworks, but for anyone in the mindfulness movement, secular mindfulness movement, can come on that. And I don't think people are going into... there probably are some people that go into teaching in the mindfulness movement so that they can help beings throughout the world become enlightened. But usually it's probably more to do with other reasons, which would be a whole variety of reasons. But the Bodhisattva ideal, which we talk about quite a lot, I assume, in our centres still, is very, very important to me too. So there are all these things for me in Tri Ratna are very clear, but it's quite complicated to start bringing those into talking to people who've got pain and illness. And we're not trying to convert people. But then Buddhist system of conversion is simply people see you, they see who you are as a teacher, as a mindfulness practitioner, and they are touched and they want more. And that is the way you draw people into the movement, isn't it? You don't set out to convert people, but people are drawn in and they want more. So there is this opening up for us in society, as Vishwapani said yesterday, that it's become more and more acceptable that you can practice meditation, mindfulness in many circles. And you don't have to go there with an agenda to convert people. I'm quite keen on helping more and more people to become Buddhist, but I wouldn't do it by going to a course and trying with thinking, I know, I'll convert him and him and him. So I just go there saying I'm a Buddhist and I'm not going to talk to you about Buddhism, I'm going to tell you about mindfulness. But people get interested. And that's it's a method of conversion. So I don't actually kind of try to think about what I do at Breathworks as an enlightening. I think it depends on the individual. It would be enlightening if an individual wants to kind of have an more enlightened experience. I think it leads to growth. I think people become more and more human, happy, healthier humans, maybe not physically healthier, but healthier psychologically. I can see that happening all the time, and I think that's a good thing. That's the basis of leading a spiritual life. I remember Bhante once saying that's the starting point. Most of us haven't reached that level yet, so that's where you kind of start living the spiritual life from. I better move on quickly. One thing about... I was thinking, okay, I'm going to give a talk to order members, men order members, dhammacharis, and about mindfulness. And I thought one of the things I have to say is that if you run a mindfulness course, most likely, if it's just to the general public, most likely the people that are going to get attracted are, guess who?
Women.
Yeah. So you're going to be talking to probably 80%, 20% women, men. That's kind of what Banger stays normal on the courses. They get, as what we definitely find at Breathworks, and I asked someone at Breathing Space, it's maybe more men because the sort of courses they do than women there. So I only mention that because if you become interested in finding out more about the mindfulness movement, you may find there's something in it that's appealing to women that's not quite appealing to men. And I don't know what that is. It may be the language. It may be, I don't know, it could be whatever. And one of the things we teach on our courses at Breathworks is something called the three emotional regulators. You'll see the connection between this and what I'm going to say and men in a minute. But we have three, according to Paul Gilbert in his book, Compassionate Mind. He and it's fairly widely accepted in psychology. We have emotional centres. So we can have, say, look at the emotional centre of threat, of activity, and of calm. Yeah. And you can see the threat emotional centre, and you see my hand is down here, and that's usually where you feel it, isn't it? If you feel threat, your stomach usually tightens up because you're in a fight and flight. Your autonomic situation, sympathetic nervous system is activated, and muscles close in certain places to pump blood to other places, so you're getting into a fight and flight mode. You release adrenaline and cortisone into the system, and you're kind of wound up, ready to do something, right? Or anxious. The other system for, and you could see that as the red zone, being in the red zone, because it's got that, you know, fiery sort of element to it. Then there's the blue zone, which is activity, which we as men love doing, don't we? Love activity. We love doing things that are where we're successful. You know, we do things and we think, God, that was good. Great, I've done that. Glad to have done that. And we could call that a blue zone because when you get into that mode of doing things and being successful, you release hormone of dopamine, which is a feel-good hormone. So that's why we feel good when we succeed at something. And so it seems as though most people today, and what advertising gets us to do, is either to worry about the red zone, you know, like your house is going to burn down while you're on holiday, so you better take out insurance. Or if you go and do a lot of climbing and, you know, and things, you'll be all really happy up here. So, when you're in the red zone, a lot of people go shopping because that's the best activity they can feel of. And then they feel good about it, but then they worry about how much money they spent, so they've gone back to the red zone. Yeah. And they seem to go up and down these two zones, you know. Does it sound familiar? There is another zone, which we know about, which is called the green zone, and that's the calm zone, where if you sit still and be with yourself and be calm, just follow your breathing, really. Just sit with your breathing, if you follow your breathing, you'll be in your body and you'll be in the present moment, which is often how mindfulness is defined. So it's just like you don't have to do anything other than just be aware of your breathing, hence breath works. And you then release endorphins, which actually calm you down and you feel good. I think the mindfulness movement for men, if I was figuring out an advertising program, but like, hey, you could do more activity better by being in the green zone. You know, you could prepare yourself to be so good and great and active by being calm. And I think that's the sort of thing I would like to see more of and see more written about in it. So, you know, there's a little mission there for those who want to undertake it. Yeah, I just wanted to warn you that if you do go into it, you may find the language. It certainly puts me off a bit. You know, when people say to me, can you do this as best you can? Can you, you know, just let go and relax as best you can? I kind of find it slightly off-putting because I'm being invited to do so. I quite like being told. And if I'm told, I can react then, and then I can deal with my reaction. But when people use the word, you know, sort of being tender and soft and calm, it's all nice and comfortable, but it's sort of like, what do I do then? And then I'm more interested in what I do then rather than that state. So there's something missing for me, obviously. That's why I mentioned it in the secular mindfulness movement. I'd like a bit more activity, and not so much calm, but it has to start with calm because most people don't have it in their life. Awareness is revolutionary. This is an aphorism of Banti's. And, it's revolutionary because it changes people. It can radically change people. People who have a health condition, you can see that it changes their life. This is why we do what we do at Breathworks. It radically changes their lives. It's radically changed Vidyamala's life. She's so different today. She actually lives the mindfulness, the Breathworks program. She's an exemplar of it. And she actually has less physical pain than she did 14 years ago. She's more mobile. She's living with less pain. There's a number of factors. We don't know exactly how much mindfulness is doing, but all the things that we teach, the pacing, being kind to yourself, caring about others, having a kind of mission in life to care about something bigger than yourself, other people, has an effect on you, and it may have quite physical effects on you. So you don't know, really. We don't know. And so it does actually have a personal transformative effect, mindfulness, partly because a lot of people just stop and they become aware of themselves. Today, compassion is kind of becoming another wave of popularity. So there are more and more courses about kindness and compassion. So far, these seem to me to be mainly limited towards oneself. It's about self-compassion. They're often called self-compassion courses. And that's a good starting point, because if you can't be kind to yourself, then, you can't really care about others properly. So there is, it's so interesting, really. There's mindfulness, there's compassion, and there's Buddhism. And it's kind of like all these things seem to be converging somehow. I mean, I don't think they ever will, but I don't think society will necessarily become Britain. I can't imagine Britain becoming a Buddhist country. We had to, thank God last night. Sorry, I shouldn't tell you this, but I went to a concert last night, and at the beginning of the concert, someone read out something, and then he thanked God, and we had to sit there, thank God. And so I thought, oh, it's going to take a long time to change this thing to Buddhism. But it's interesting. There's compassion, there's mindfulness, and there's a Buddhist teaching. And, in Tree Ratna, we have all these things. And I can't see how... I can't see why we can't take advantage of this sudden, of this large popularity, this massive popularity in mindfulness, and just give people a bit more than mindfulness, by perhaps just by us being ourselves, by going out and interacting. Suddenly people want to interact with us because we meditate. This is perhaps, it's never happened before in my lifetime on the scale. It's never happened before. People, the world want to interact with us because we meditate. We can sit still and do nothing. Most people can't. And it's very de-stressing. And it's very, just becoming de-stressed is transformative. Teaching people to like themselves, to be kind. And it's all right to be kind to yourself. You should be kind to yourself, I could invite you to be kind to yourself, or I could tell you, just be kind to yourself. It's great. And and when people are kind to themselves, they love it. And of course they do. You suddenly think, oh, thank God for that. I've gone all through my life not being kind to myself. And I'm sure there are people in this room that have this sort of moment where they realise they've been doing all these things for other people, and actually they haven't really been, worrying about themselves enough. But it's not simple, but it's a great message. And it's transformative. It is revolutionary for people. So there's mindfulness, but it's not just mindfulness. There is awareness. If you sit long enough and allow yourself to become sensitized, and you develop other things like aesthetic experiences, awareness of sort of higher faculties, of ability to perceive more in a more aesthetic sense, then you'll probably come more and more in touch with the spiritual, whatever that is. And if you're coming in touch with higher, whatever it is, the higher states of reality or mind or whatever, that's going to transform you too. If you're in touch with the arts, and allow the arts to speak to you, that's transformative. It's revolutionary for a lot of people. It was certainly revolutionary for me as a young man coming into contact with Banti. He gave me so many novels to read. They were so transformative. I mean, he gave me a Dharma teaching, but the novels were the things that I remember more and how it changed my life, some of those. And all these things are there. So there's such a wonderful opportunity that we could grab the day as order members. And remember, when we go beyond ourselves, and scientific research is proving this, when we care about others and we're generous and we give money away, we're happier. And we feel more expansive. We don't feel such a narrow little victim to our circumstances. Life works better for us. And everything goes much more smoothly. So I would like to advocate you thinking seriously about involving yourself, particularly with breathworks, and becoming a maybe training up to be a breathworks teacher, but there's lots of other ways of teaching mindfulness too. And I hope that's given you a few things to talk about in your groups. So thank you very much.